The opportunity afforded me tonight is both welcome and terrifying. With these mingled feelings, I invite you, first of all, to take a rapid glance in Christian perspective at the world scene today. The Christian knows that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. Yet our confidence that we live in God's world and the comparative security which our immediate surroundings here suggest do not permit us to ignore the tragic and threatening problems by which the children of men are beset. The peoples of Germany, Korea, Vietnam remain unnaturally and forcibly divided. The unresolved issues of the Middle East continue explosive. Cyprus and Algeria are calling for an opportunity to determine their political future. Nations which have recently won their independence seek for their citizens a reasonable standard of living and a place of equality in the family of nations. Wherever totalitarian forces dominate, human rights are violated and the freedom to speak and act by conscience is restricted or denied. More refugees appear with every new upheaval, while solutions are still being sought for those who have lived too long in suffering and without prospect of relief. The tenacious hold of international communism upon peoples who desire to govern themselves and the ever-present threat of its expansion have spurred an armaments race, the end of which is not in sight. Men contemplate the awesome possibility of destruction by nuclear power even as they strive to harness it for beneficial uses. In viewing this troubled scene, our conviction that God is the judge of history forbids a complacent otherworldliness, for we are involved in this world's guilt. Yet our faith that God is also the sovereign Lord of history dispels fear and despair, for God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. In placing our confidence here, we cannot yield to the inevitability of war and bloodshed, nor to the perpetuation of injustice. We hold before our eyes the vision of a world where peace and justice shall prevail. In simple terms, which we can all understand and which reflect our deepest longings, what does this mean? We seek a world where nations shall beat their swords into plowshares, or if you will, where nations shall convert their atomic power to peaceful purposes and dwell together in comity and goodwill, where men and women in their domestic communities can determine their faith by conscience and freely express it, subject only to the rights of others, where they can choose their vocation and have equal opportunity to pursue it, where they can freely select their own governments, where they can rear their children to meet the responsibilities of an oncoming generation, where they can satisfy legitimate material needs, where their concern to every possible extent the expression of it can reach to their fellow men round the world. In painting this brief picture, I in no sense equate it with the kingdom of God or the fullness of God's purposes. But in the pursuit of these goals, the Christian will serve both God and man in temporal affairs, and in this way work for the preservation of God's order in the secular realm. What has been the response of the churches to the demand thus placed upon them? Let us note that the main contribution to peace and justice among men and nations lies in the steadfast proclamation of the gospel at home and to the uttermost parts of the world, and in the growing solidarity of a Christian fellowship which transcends race and national frontiers. From this conviction, the Commission of the Churches on International Affairs, the CCIA, was established at Cambridge, England in 1946 as the joint agent of the World Council of Churches and the International Missionary Council. Time does not permit even a limited description of the worldwide organization of this commission and the work undertaken by it. However, convinced that every Christian would give much to make a contribution to world peace and justice, let me portray in rapid impressions the witness that has been offered in your behalf over the last decade. In the tall, modern buildings on the East River in New York, the representatives of 81 member governments of the United Nations assembled to consider issues relating to the prevention of war and the promotion of peace. You were there on many occasions through your church representatives, and a voice was raised in your behalf on issues such as religious freedom, disarmament, legitimate aspirations of dependent peoples, refugees, economic and technical assistance, and the Middle East and Hungarian crises last October and November. And you will be there in less than a month when the 12th session of the General Assembly opens and a Christian word will be raised on many of the agenda items before that session. At the time when the preliminary armistice negotiations in Korea seemed destined to failure, you were represented in Seoul to press for a truce on honorable terms, and your prayers, or prayers in your behalf, were offered with President Syngman Rhee and the Honorable Walter Robertson, representing the United Nations High Command. You were at the Berlin Foreign Ministers Conference when a letter was addressed to all principal participants reflecting concern. A service of ecumenical intercession coincided with a summit conference at Geneva, and perhaps you participated personally as millions of Christians in churches round the world joined in prayer to Almighty God that He would guide the nations into the ways of peace and righteousness. Representatives of the CCIA have met with officials of church and state in many countries on all continents to discuss problems that threaten the peace. This work, which is dependent for its effectiveness upon the prayers and support of Christians everywhere, is only a meager beginning. Yet it is an effort to harness worldwide Christian resources for day-to-day ongoing Christian action and to raise a voice in behalf of the churches at the time and place of international decision. I would consider myself remiss if I limited myself, even at this late hour, solely to a recital of what has been attempted. There is a Christian responsibility to indicate the direction which nations should follow and to set forth particularly those methods and motives which spring from a moral and spiritual base. We therefore must turn to the question of new dynamics for peace and justice and freedom in an atomic age. The development of nuclear weapons with their potential of catastrophic destruction makes total war unthinkable as an instrument of national or international policy. The leaders of all governments recognize that in the event of such large-scale conflict, neither side could be a conclusive victor. Total war becomes a possibility only as the act of a madman. And even limited war or local conflicts, it is recognized, carry the danger of progressive expansion toward total war. Christians must therefore stand for peace and do everything in their power to prevent war. But Christians must also stand for justice and do everything in their power to promote it. Here is the major paradox of our atomic age: seek peace and justice. To pursue both goals effectively will require the identification and development of new dynamics in international affairs. I bring together for the first time tonight five forms of action which I believe commend themselves to the Christian conscience and which Christians are called upon to support. In each of these, there is needed a combination of firmness and flexibility, of realism and courageous imagination. I shall, however, not develop them fully, allowing that opportunity may be afforded subsequently to read the text. The first is the application of moral force. Recognizing the danger or futility of recourse to war, government leaders, not church leaders now, government leaders concerned with international affairs are seeking to utilize moral force for the solution of problems. Here we encounter both pitfalls and possibilities. Note just a few of the dangers. The assumption that international problems can be solved merely by moral principles. Technical arrangements are needed. The danger of ivory tower indulgence or starry-eyed dreaming, whereas frequently it's necessary to submit to the discipline of the achievable, always keeping a higher goal in view. Or the danger of recourse to morality as a cloak to defend selfish interest, instead of a consistent application of moral requirements to all parties, including ourselves, even though the shoe pinches. My reference to these dangers in no sense minimizes the importance of moral factors. But we must recognize the dangers and then press for the kind of action which reflects moral principles. As Christians, we believe there is a moral law. As Christians, we believe there is a distinction between right and wrong, and we should encourage government officials when they seek to apply such principles. The results from the application of moral force will not always be immediate or similar, and patience will be needed. Look, for example, at what happened in Egypt and Hungary, where no military power was available to enforce decisions of the United Nations. Let me express the conviction that the compliance of the United Kingdom, France, and Israel with the United Nations' recommendation to withdraw from Egyptian territory will go down in history as a landmark in the development of an international order. But let me say further that in its failure to comply with the United Nations' action, the Soviet Union suffered the most severe reversal in its history, and the events of Hungary will not be forgotten. Second, positive risk for peace, another dynamic. There are many instances where a clear-cut way to break an international impasse is not apparent, and there's need to be willing to take a positive, calculated risk. Consider the illustration of nuclear tests and disarmament. I'm personally of the opinion that no one should advocate the cessation of nuclear experiments unless he has first struggled with the dilemmas and conflicts which confront responsible government officials. For example, the increasing dependence upon atomic deterrence and the mounting stockpiles of atomic weapons heighten the danger that atomic weapons will at some point actually be used and that Pandora's box will be opened. Yet, in the judgment of many, our present insecure peace rests mainly upon the possession of atomic deterrence on both sides of a divided world, and upon the suicidal character of war. Or take this conflict. The various objectives of effective disarmament are interdependent. Take this too: to stop nuclear tests and to halt the production of nuclear weapons. The possibility that an initial separate agreement to stop tests will make it more difficult to get a reliable agreement to halt production of nuclear weapons, which is far more fundamental, cannot be lightly dismissed. I mention these dilemmas not with a view to evading the responsibility for decision, but when the inherent difficulties are recognized, a person is better prepared to take a positive risk for peace and justice in an atomic age. It was on the basis of such an analysis that the CCIA Executive Committee, subsequently the Central Committee of the World Council of Churches, yesterday the Lutheran World Federation in this assembly, stated that if persistent efforts fail to produce adequate agreements on these interrelated objectives, Christians are justified in urging governments to forego tests for a trial period in the hope that others will do the same, a new confidence be born, and most importantly, foundations laid for reliable agreements. This, my Christian friends, is not merely a pious wish. This is a proposal that a positive risk for peace be taken. And if the proposal is followed, we must share in the responsibility for what may subsequently happen. But note that if this risk is not taken, another positive approach must be looked for and found in order to break the impasse. The third dynamic for peace and justice in an atomic age has to do with mechanisms for peaceful change and peaceful settlement. Injustices persist in many parts of the world. Every effort should be made to remove these by processes of peaceful change. This often involves a slow and a tortuous process. Our sympathy, deeper than words can convey, goes out to those who are forced to suffer under such continuing injustices. To ask for patience when the end is not in sight sounds hollow and vain. Yet the pathway of peaceful change must be attempted, for war may well increase rather than remedy existing injustices. Meanwhile, to those who suffer injustice, we must give assurance not only of our sympathy, but also of our firm commitment to take positive action both with them and in their behalf. Committed to such a procedure, we nevertheless recognize the possibility that local conflicts will break out. With this threat in view, the international community must strengthen existing mechanisms or develop new ones to facilitate prompt and peaceful settlement. This has to be done by previous special agreement of the nations, where a majority vote will rule and the veto right cannot operate. And a ceasefire when conflicts break out, conflicts that are internationally critical, must be promptly demanded. A peace observation team or an emergency force promptly sent, and investigation of the injustices existing carried out by an impartial agency. The important requirement is that nations should commit themselves in advance to such steps. And the world has to get to be mature enough to do this if it wants to find a positive alternative to war. The fourth dynamic, the principle of reconciliation. The first assembly at Lund stated reconciliation must become a consistently operating principle in human relations. I have worked out the theological undergirding for the application of this to political life, nation and nation. I feel that this is not the opportunity to take it up with you, but let me say, from the Christian standpoint, reconciliation has been made possible by an act of God in history, the incarnation, the crucifixion, and the resurrection. The Christian who has heard and responded to the message of reconciliation to God in Jesus Christ knows the depths of its meaning and is best equipped to interpret it in human-human and nation-nation relations. I merely mention here that Christians have a great opportunity and responsibility to show the way of reconciliation. Where there are substantial or even minority groups of Christians in countries between which serious difficulties exist, they can, in their own fellowship, bridge the gulf which divides governments and perhaps pave the way, first for a confession of guilt, if people are sufficiently sensitive to the guilt of their governments. Second, when an offending nation does not have that sensitiveness, people in nations that do have a Christian majority must convince their governments to be ready for reconciliation when the moment and the opportunity arrives. But let us not deceive ourselves. In this evil world, reconciliation may not deteriorate into appeasement. And we must constantly be on the lookout for the welfare of the world community and guard against lack of good faith on the part of those to whom we seek to be reconciled. Of particular importance is the question of timing. Such efforts at reconciliation as have been historically made in most instances have become operative after a war or conflict, as in the case of the Japanese peace treaty. In the world of tension which threatens human well-being, and perhaps even human existence at this hour of history, there is need to bring into play the forces of reconciliation before a conflict and as a means of preventing war. I add a fifth dynamic, which in a sense supplements the four I have already considered, and I call it anticipating history. While we are not gifted with prophecy, There are certain inevitabilities of history, and we must act today in full anticipation of them. For example, the economic disparity, as we have heard this evening, between the more favored and the less advanced countries is increasing. Such a situation cannot make for a peaceful and just world. The peoples of the less advanced countries today constitute the large majority of the world's population, and it requires little prophetic insight to see that they will be the people of tomorrow. Justice, as well as self-interest and future peace, requires that the eyes of our so-called Western world be opened and that mutual assistance go forward wisely and cooperatively, but in a magnitude which will match the inevitability of future history. Peace, justice, and freedom in an atomic age is a slogan which can unite Christians and to which all men of goodwill can rally. The new dynamics, which I have merely briefly touched upon, needed to achieve such goals, call for new insights, as well as for patience and courage, not only by people, but by governments. In conclusion, I quote a brief word from the Evanston International Affairs Report, which I have found a source of comfort and strength when the going is tough. This troubled world, distorted and disfigured as it is still God's world. He rules and overrules its tangled history. In praying, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," we commit ourselves to seek earthly peace, justice, and freedom for all men. Here, as everywhere, Christ is our hope. Our confidence lies not in our own reason or strength, but in the power that comes from God. Impelled by this faith, all our actions will be but humble, grateful, obedient acknowledgement that He has redeemed the world. The fruit of our efforts rests in His hands. We can therefore live and work as those who know that God reigns, undaunted by all the arrogant pretensions of evil, ready to face situations that seem to be hopeless, but to act in them as men whose hope